This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 44. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or are just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's going on this week, Rob?
Well, I just got back from Vancouver. I spoke at a Lean Startup conference. That was a lot of fun. I find the Lean Startup crowd is kind of divided into a couple of groups. There's the half of it that's really gung-ho for it, and they're all about it, and they know about it. And then the other half are people who are like, they either just don't really understand it or they're very skeptical of it. I think the latter half might be larger than the first half, at least up at the Vancouver conference. It was a good crowd. Honestly, just a good mix of people and some very knowledgeable, both speakers and attendees at the conference. It was about 150 people. I had a great time, met some good contacts and stuff.
Cool.
Had a lot of fun.
I think I probably fall more into the latter half, to
yeah,
be perfectly
you're more,
honest.
You know some stuff about it and you're a little skeptical, right?
Yeah. I heard Eric talk about it at the Business of Software. And I have to be honest, I do like some of the fundamental ideas. You know, one of the ones that struck me was having build machines that if your code passes all the tests, just go ahead and push it live.
Right, the continuous deployment. Yeah.
Yeah, that seemed interesting to me. And I think from an engineering standpoint, it probably scares me a lot more than it probably should, I guess.
No, that it's pretty scary.
Okay.
You have a lot in place in order to do that. I mean, they talk about like having all these metrics built into your site so that you know if sales suddenly were to dip, you know, if you had an e-commerce site, if sales were suddenly to dip, then you know something's wrong. But boy, some companies I've worked at, like that, it would be too late, you know?
I was
at a credit card company and it's like it was catastrophic if monetary things went wrong. So
yeah.
So I agree. I think it's an interesting approach. I learned so much about it at the conference. That was cool to hear the other speakers. They all spoke on lean topics and I was the one guy who didn't. You know, I spoke about my experience and kind of the micropreneur approach and finding a market first and that kind of stuff. And I talked a lot about the failures I've had. I dug a few more up for this talk. So I was not talking about lean stuff at all. And as a result, I got a really good education in it. I would agree with you. I think parts of it are really cool and ingenious. And I think other parts are really kind of academic in the sense that I don't know if they'll work, you know, like on, they might work for certain types of companies in certain scenarios, but to think that they could be applied across all or even most software development kind of, startup scenarios is, I don't know. I'd have to be convinced. I think I tend to be more of a skeptic, though, in these things. I remember when Agile came out, I kind of felt that way.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's probably true.
I don't know. I would want to insert like an artificial step in there that says, okay, you can go ahead and go through all those things and then give me a button that says, everything's passed. Are you sure? And then
right.
I have to click the button. I would probably feel a lot more comfortable about that than I would about, anybody can check something in. And as long as it passes all the tests, then go for it. You know, what happens if they forgot to check in the test for everything they just checked in?
Sure. You know? Well, this process is supposed to catch that and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But no, I do think that if there was a button, that would actually, I bet Eric or I would guess that they would say that's a good thing because you'd put a button in there and you would click it and it would work. And then you'd click it again the next day and the next day. And then after a while, you'd be like, I'm tired of clicking this button. It always works. And you'd eventually just get rid of the button and then it would work and it'd be continuous deployment. And that's like a perfectly reasonable step to have in there temporarily, you know, until you're comfortable enough to really jump off the bridge and go with the lean startup stuff.
Right. So.
Any case, I definitely think there's some things to be learned from it. And I'm speaking again this week in Michigan, Grand Rapids, at another lean startup thing. And Eric Reese will be speaking there. And so hope to learn a little more.
Cool.
Excellent. How about you? You said you've been doing some dev work.
Oh, yeah. I took a couple of weeks off and just kind of dove headfirst into working on Audit Shark. And it's coming along really well. I had a meeting with Microsoft last Wednesday, I believe it was, and they brought me into their Cambridge office. So I went in there and talked to one of their architects for, probably 2 or 3 hours, just kind of explaining what the product I had was and then talking about, you know, I spent maybe 5 minutes explaining what it was and how it addressed a problem in the market and then spent the next 2 hours talking over the architecture and explaining all the different pieces. And he was kind of floored, to be perfectly honest. It's there's a lot to it, and it leverages a lot of different technologies. It's, you know, I think I've told you before, it's got its own built-in scripting language, and it's extremely flexible. And a lot of the complexity is just abstracted away from the user, so they don't need to know all the stuff that goes into it. And so far, the stuff that I've put together, it just kind of works. So it's coming along well. I've still got a couple of major pieces that are left that need to be put in place, but you know, I'm kind of hopeful that I'll still be able to put it out next month and before my deadline of what did I say, the 27th of June?
Mm-hmm. Something like that, yeah.
So, yeah, still got a little bit of time left to work on it. But, you know, I'm hopeful I'll be able to meet that. And at the very least, I want to have, you know, an alpha or beta version out there. I mean, I'm kind of reining things in a little bit at this point, but I don't think it's wise to push something out there and say, okay, well, I finished with the dev work and I'm just going to start trying to sell it. I think it needs to be beta tested for, you know, just because of the fact of what it does.
Right. Well, good work. Good work, so making progress on it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when this goes live, actually, we will be at MicroConf.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Hopefully, it'll go live on a Tuesday, and that'll be the second day of MicroConf. So.
Yep.
We have, I think, a fun topic today, and pretty much off the cuff, much less outlined than a lot of our other podcasts are. But this one is basically called Our Top 3 Book Recommendations. And so you and I decided to go over to our bookshelf. That was the thing is, it's easy to get grandiose with this, right? And to say, Mike, what are your top 3 books of all time? And you're like, well, one is the dictionary and the other is the Bible. And, you know, and you get really grandiose. And it's like, Mike and I said, let's go to our bookshelf and look. Because to me, it's an indicator if you have a book on your bookshelf or on your Kindle, you know, that it has value to you. And that if it's within reach of where you're working, then I think it's worth recommending. And so we basically said, no technical books. I don't want to recommend an ASP.NET book because it just doesn't apply to a lot of our audience. It didn't have to be about business or marketing, but we did want it to somehow be, you know, related to our personal or entrepreneurial growth over the past 10, 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it. So we each chose books and then came together. And coincidentally, we did not choose any of the same books, which I think is kind of cool.
Yeah.
And these are in no particular order.
The first one that I picked was Crossing the Chasm by Geoffrey Moore. And I picked this up, God, I don't even remember when I picked this up. It was a long time ago.
Probably in the 90s, right? I mean, that's when I remember first reading it or reading parts of it.
I think it was probably early 2000s. But I picked it up and, you know, I read through it and it was very enlightening. To me, it seemed more like a book about how to sell to, you know, technology companies. And that was more the way I interpreted it than anything else. It wasn't necessarily its primary focus. But the basic idea was how to take a product that you've developed and you'll get to a certain point in your marketing strategies and you'll get some early adopters who are essentially running into some problems or issues and they're experiencing so much pain that they are willing to pay any price to have whatever it is that you're offering to solve that pain point. And they're willing to take the risks on your product as opposed to trying to buy something from a major vendor like IBM or Microsoft that is probably not going to work, but it's a safe buy, I'll say, even though they know it's not going to solve all their problems. But it takes you through the process of what, you know, the 4 different stages of the selling process are and then shows you that a lot of companies have problems at that point where there's this chasm where you're trying to get to the people who are a little bit more conservative and you're trying to get to the essentially what is the mass market of those people who are going to be your core audience, which are going to take your business to the next level. But that's where a lot of companies fall short. And that's where, you know, you try to get to those people and you try to reach them and maybe you've got some sales under your belt and you've done okay. You probably haven't done great, but you've made some sales. And that's kind of the important part that, you know, you got to get your feet wet in order to get rolling. And then you get to a point where you don't seem to be making any progress. And that's where this book really comes into play. And it kind of shows you how a lot of different companies have made the leap across that chasm and started taking their sales to the next level. It uses a lot of illustrations from different industries and different products that, you know, should largely be familiar to most people. But it was just very enlightening in the way that it presented all that information.
Right. And now this book has that famous diagram that's I've seen in so many presentations since then. Mm. It talks about like your technology enthusiasts. It's basically a bell curve and it has the technology enthusiasts are the first people who will probably adopt your technical product.
Yeah.
And the visionaries are after that. And then there's this big chasm and making it from visionaries to pragmatists, as Geoffrey Moore calls them. that's the chasm, and that's really what the book is about getting across.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And the pragmatist is a huge market. It's like you said, it's the mass market. But I actually don't know that I've ever read the entire book. I read the first half of it. You know, a friend of mine worked for Palm back when they were still owned by 3Com. This is like late 90s, early 2000s. And every Palm employee at the time was given a copy when they started. And the company was probably several hundred or a couple thousand at the time. It was pretty small compared to where they grew. But that's why he got it for me. And it was pretty enlightening for me at the time, pretty eye-opening to think that this is how you could think about the a market. And I still think it applies, frankly.
Yeah, and I think that's the best part, is that it's so non-technology specific that it really can apply to any technology. And the fact is that it can also apply to a lot of other industries, but, you know, more specifically that, you know, for selling software, it's really beneficial to kind of see what this book has to offer.
Right. Cool. Well, you know, just as a side note, Jeffrey Moore spoke at 2009 Business of Software, and I think his talk is online as a video. Highly recommend it. Super, super smart dude. And his talk is awesome. So we'll try to link it up in the show notes if we can.
Very cool.
All right, so my first book is Eric Sink on the Business of Software. And this is a classic. I'm sure this is on the library of many developer entrepreneurs. Funny thing is every time I pick this up, I look at the copyright. What year do you think this was published?
2007.
Oh man. It's 2006. I always think, I don't know why, but I always think it's earlier. I always think it's 2002, 2003.
Well, I think that, and I haven't read that, to be perfectly honest, but isn't it a lot of what you find on his blog?
It is. I think you could read probably everything in here on his blog. It's so much nicer that it's collected like this. But so back in the day, right, I've been reading Joel on Software since like late 2000, early 2001, like really, really early on. And then I didn't think there was anyone else in the world, you know, that was writing about this stuff. And I found Paul Graham and Eric Sink within a couple years of that. And so I followed those guys and I read each of their books. Paul Graham obviously had Hackers and Painters, which is more... it's more entrepreneurial and less practical, I guess. It's a cool book, but it's different. And then Joel's book was, well, I liked it a lot as well. But Eric really hit the nail on the head for me. This book is broken up into four parts. It's first part's entrepreneurship. Second part is about people. So it's about like managing and hiring. And the third part is about marketing, which resonated with me. And the last part's about sales. Now, the interesting thing is I went back and reread this book maybe a year ago. And with classics like this, I find that on the reread, it wasn't as unique anymore because so much has been built on top of it. So many people have kind of stood on the shoulders of giants, essentially, right? Stood on the shoulders of Eric Sink and have built things that are now, I'd say, they go beyond what this book does. It felt very rudimentary to me, which I think is probably a good sign. It's like, oh, I've progressed. You know, that means that if I look back and I say, oh, this is basic stuff. Well, it wasn't basic to me when I first read it 5 years ago. Anyways, that's my pitch. I know you've read this, Mike, right? Like, what do you...
I haven't, actually. I know. Well, like I said, I thought that it was just mostly a collection of the things on his blog. And, you know, like you, I've been following Eric Sink's blog since early 2000s. You know, I mean, unless there's something in there that's not on his blog, chances are good, I've probably already read it.
Yep. No, that's a good point.
So,
oh, cool. That's funny. I thought you'd read it. I'm sure you have read all or most of it. I think there were some essays in here. One is called Marketing is Not a Post-Processing Step.
Mm-hmm.
And it's from 2003. See, that's why I think of this from being back then. But that one article was just totally blew me away. And that's why, like today, I think marketing starts before development and goes all the way through it.
Mm-hmm.
So some good stuff in here, man. If you haven't read this, if you've never read it, I do recommend it. There's still a lot of gems in here, even though, like I said, people have built on it and some parts of it may seem, I don't know, it's like going back and watching a good, like Blade Runner, like a good sci-fi movie that you've never seen that's old. You kind of say, oh, well, this is cliche. And it's like, well, it's cliche because everyone copied it. Like it was the original, you know, and that's what this book is to me.
It's really funny that you mentioned Blade Runner because I just saw it for the first time, like 2 years ago.
Yeah. And did you think you thought it was lame probably?
No, because I looked at it from the perspective of knowing that it was first made like 20 some years ago. So I knew that that was the first, that was kind of the stepping stone for a lot of these other movies that have followed after. And I also knew that the special effects were not going to be stellar. I walked into it knowing that. But I looked at it for more from a story perspective than anything else. So yeah. I didn't think it was a bad movie at all.
Right. It was made in 82, man. The effects for 1982 was pretty impressive.
Yeah.
It was epic when it came out.
So almost 30 years ago.
Yeah. Really impressive when you think about it.
But yeah, I mean, I thought from a story perspective, you know, definitely top notch. And there were certainly some questions that it brought up. One of them was like, you know, who was, you know, was this person actually a replicant or something like that? Is that what
giving the end away? So that's the interesting thing, is it's based on a book by a sci-fi author, Philip K. Dick. And that's why the story is so good, probably, right? It's based on, you know, a book. And in the book, there's a lot of questions about whether Harrison Ford's a replicant, Decker. If you look at the director's cut, it copied the book. But if you look at the theatrical release, that was the only release out there for about probably until the mid-90s, mm-hmm. so probably almost 15 years, it had nothing. It did not question Decker's humanness.
Mm.
It just didn't have those. There's a couple scenes that it didn't have. So anyway, so you probably saw the director's cut.
I think so.
So we're
that's a little off topic, but that's okay.
Yeah, but I think people are interested in Blade Runner.
Oh, maybe.
All right. What's your number two?
So the number two that I have is the 22 Immutable Laws of Marketing by Al Reiss and Jack Trout. And I flipped this one open, and I just love the very first one. It says, number one, the law of leadership. It's better to be first than it is to be better. And every single one of these laws has this little one, possibly two-line quote at the very beginning that just kind of summarizes a fairly large topic. I mean, the book itself is only, I don't know, 125 pages, 130 pages, something like that. But it summarizes what they call these 22 immutable laws of marketing. And they help provide insight into marketing from a non-developer standpoint. I mean, if you're a developer and you're pretty technical and you start getting into marketing and trying to figure it out and say, okay, well, you know, I'm a developer, I'm a pretty smart guy, you know, marketing can't possibly be that hard. And then you try it and then you fall completely flat on your face because you have no idea what you're doing. And you say, well, either one, I'm not as smart as I thought I was, which nobody really wants to think that, or, you know, the marketing guys aren't nearly as dumb as I thought they were. So there's a lot of things in here that are eye-opening that, you know, really kind of help improve your perception of what marketing really is and why certain things work and why certain things don't.
Yeah, I've read this book as well. I think this was another one where I read it after I had read other books. And so it seemed pretty rudimentary to me.
Mm-hmm.
But realistically, it's the immutable laws of marketing. So they're going to be really general and kind of foundational things. So I can't say that I took anything away from this book that I went and applied to any of my products. And that tends to be my measure, you know, of things. Like, am I kind of putting a to-do list or at least a vision list of like some things I want to do down the line? And this book didn't do that for me because it was so general. It's more academic than practical, but I don't think that's a bad thing. It's a very short book, which totally makes it kind of worth an hour. I think it took me like 90 minutes or something to read. So I definitely think it's worth taking a look at. The other thing that you and I were discussing before this is that Eric Sink did, but it's basically a series of blog posts that he later put into a PDF. And it was like Eric Sink's take on the immutable laws of marketing as applied to software marketing. I was fascinated by that just because it's a really smart guy applying these other really smart guys' principles to what we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he actually calls it, you know, the 22 immutable laws of marketing. He has a blog post from, I'm looking at it now, it's Tuesday, June 1st, 2004. And then he lists these 22 laws, and he says he's going to summarize the main point and draw a connection to the software industry. And he does have a PDF version. So I do have the link. We will link it up in the show notes. It is interesting to not only read the book, but then to also see Eric's take on it and how exactly a lot of these things can apply to the software industry. And if you haven't read either one of them, definitely read the book and then take a look at Eric Sink's post on, you know, how it applies to the software industry. And it's very enlightening. And like you said, the entire book is very generic. It's very foundational. And if you don't have very much marketing experience. I mean, this is one of the first marketing books that I had ever picked up, and you know, it taught me a lot. It really did. And you know, I look back on it now and say, oh yeah, that stuff's pretty rudimentary. But at the time, you know, I was kind of just starting out, and said, yeah, it was inspirational, I'll say.
And my number two is called The Ultimate Sales Letter. And it's a book by Dan Kennedy. And of course, I need to hedge my bet here because Dan Kennedy, I have kind of a love-hate relationship with this guy. Basically, he's a very talented copywriter and he knows how to push buttons, right? He knows the psychology of marketing. So he's very knowledgeable. At the same time, a lot of what I hear him do and when I've heard him speak, I've never seen him live, but when I've heard, you know, audio of him speaking, he seems just like a guy who I don't want to emulate. He's one of those marketers that you're like, ugh. He just seems a little slimy or a little over the top. He does some stuff that I personally wouldn't do. I'm not saying he's unethical or illegal or anything like that, but the feeling that I get from some of his sales letters is like that icky feeling that, you know, you're getting sold to really hard type thing. So he wrote this book. So what I did reading through it is there's some genius in here. And bottom line, this guy knows what he's doing. He's been doing it for years. He's a, you know, multi-billionaire from doing it. I learned a ton about copywriting. And in it, he looks at how to write a sales letter. And, you know, sales letters are the things that direct response marketers used to print out on paper and mail using direct mail. And so they have to kind of make a sale in one sitting while someone's sitting over the wastebasket getting ready to throw their mail out. And so they're quite pushy and they use a lot of specific tactics. Now, what I took away from it, since, of course, I don't market that way, but he goes into how to write headlines and how to craft them. And this information has been invaluable to me when even like writing emails to people that I want to get read, you know, to think more about what the subject should say, because that's your headline. And it's totally taught me to think twice about how I title my talks at presentations, at conferences, and how I title my blog posts, as well as when I'm creating a sales website for, you know, a new product or revamping one. A lot of what I do and the tactics and my thought process deals with things that Dan Kennedy points out in this book. I definitely recommend it. Even though everything doesn't apply, it's pretty fundamental to understanding how people make buying decisions and what triggers you can focus on that your product fulfills, essentially.
Does he describe in there, I believe I read someplace, and maybe it was something by him, but there's a number of different emotional triggers that you can use.
Yep.
Does he talk about that?
He does. Now, the one you're thinking of is Cialdini's influence, the one that actually goes on the specific. It's Robert Cialdini, and he wrote a book called Influence back in the, it was a long time ago, 60s, 70s probably. And since then, it's been, there's some updated versions and new interpretations of it. But yes, Dan Kennedy does talk about them in the context of writing a sales letter.
Okay.
It's basically like there are six motivators for why people do stuff. One is fear. Two is the possibility of gain. Three is, you know, and those are just the basic human motivators. So that's my number two.
Okay. So my number three is called Focus. The Future of Your Company Depends on It. And it's by Al Rice, who is also one of the co-authors of the 22 Immutable Laws of Marketing. And in this book, he really kind of expands upon one of the immutable laws of marketing, but he basically goes to talk about if you're running a company, you really should focus on one narrow thing. So, for example, BMW owns driving and FedEx owns overnight, for example. He basically takes those and uses them as examples to kind of illustrate how if you are trying to grow your company, you should focus on some of your core products and get rid of things that are kind of side businesses, things that you're not really focused on, but maybe they're making money. So you keep doing them. But at the same time, by doing that, you're actually dividing your attention from what your core focus is or what it should be. And in doing so, you're actually reducing the profits from that core venture.
So I've never read it. Is it a marketing book? Is it about positioning and focusing in your marketing? Or is it about how once you start marketing to, if BMW focuses in their marketing on driving, then it kind of ripples through the whole company?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Or is it both of those things? Or is it more of kind of a just a marketing book? Not just, but is it more of a marketing focus?
It's more of a marketing focus. I mean, it has a bazillion examples in here. It talks about working through implementing those changes into your company, you know, what it takes, why you should do these different things and how to justify it to, you know, for example, your employees or your investor or what have you, how to define yourself within a particular product category so that when somebody says X, they think of you as opposed to whoever the next competitor possibly is.
Sounds interesting.
It's kind of long, to be perfectly honest. It's like two. Yeah.
Okay, so I was going to ask you, because it sounds to me like you could kind of, just by the way you've described it, because I haven't read it. I've probably never even seen it.
I'm vastly oversimplifying it.
Okay. Okay, I was like, it sounds like I could get that from like 50 or 100 pages and a few examples.
It's 250 pages. I mean, they do have a summary at the very end. You might be able to get by and get a lot of the gist of it out of just reading that. But like I said, this thing is jam-packed with examples. Like every single, like even on a single page, I mean, there's anywhere from, you know, 1 to 10 or 15 different examples per page. I mean, it's ridiculous the number of places they point to all these different ways that people have made money and how they've changed their industry. So, for example, they have like Jack. They talk a little bit about Jack Daniels. They talk about Blue Jeans. They talk about White Castle, Wendy's, Taco Bell. You know, all these different industries that, you know, people are well acquainted with, and they talk about how they got there and where they made missteps along the way, and then kind of refocus what they were doing to get back on track.
Do you think it applies to smaller companies? Because all the companies you named are larger. I imagine those are all the case studies they give because they're the ones that are well known. But do you take anything away from it that could be applied to like Audit Shark or any of our apps?
You know, I did. I mean, I don't think that was really the core focus of the book itself. I mean, I think that the book was more targeted towards those larger companies. But what I took away from it was that in order to take business away from a larger company, what you need to do is you need to focus your marketing efforts on a small subset of their customers. So if you're going after, and this would be kind of a ridiculous example, but let's say you're going after, you know, the operating system market. You don't want to compete against Microsoft. They own the desktop. There's no way you're going to win there. But you might be able to compete on servers. You know, obviously Linux has had a lot of success there. And if you look at the distribution of operating system licenses on servers versus desktops, on desktops, Microsoft's got like 90%+ penetration there. And on servers, it's a lot lower. I mean, granted, they still probably have a dominant number, but I'm guessing here maybe it's 50-50. I'm not real sure. But Linux actually has a pretty sizable market share when you think about, you know, what its roots were and where it came from. If I were to try and go into the operating system market, you know, the desktop is probably a bad bet. Servers would be a bad bet. What about mobile devices? And if you take a look at Apple, for example, you know, you've got OS X, which they've kind of repositioned. And now you've got the iPad, you've got the iPhone. You know, that right there is just an example off the top of my head that I came up with. Could I personally do it? Probably not, because operating systems are, you know, you need a lot of people to build an operating system. But if you're going to build a much smaller piece of software to go after invoicing software, you're going to go after...
Hey, wait, are you suggesting people compete with me? You've seen if I was awake. Huh?
I don't know, maybe. I was talking for a while. So, yeah. You know what I mean. But you know what I mean. Something that would be significant enough for one person to actually build and, you know, market effectively on their own or in a small team. Something along those lines that is definitely worth your time and effort to think about, okay, well, what sub-segment of, you know, the QuickBooks market could I go after, which they're not going to care about, but at the same time, I could have some good success at? Because chances are good that if you're building any product that has any sort of size to it, you're going to be competing with one of those people. And if you can build a product that is going to have some stripped down pieces to it that's going to specifically apply to them, then you're going to do quite well. One example that I've seen in the past was there's a piece of software out there that is specifically designed for writing research papers, and it's not Microsoft Word. And they sell it for several hundred dollars, and they do extremely well with it.
It's totally my example. You've read my book, haven't you?
Did I?
Yeah, I use it in my book. Thank you, everyone. Finally, we have proven that Mike read my book. Yeah, nota bene.
Yeah. All right. Well, maybe that's where I read it. I
accidentally read your book. Yep. Is what you're gonna.
Damn.
Mike always tells me I don't read your stuff.
Rob paid me to write.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, cool. So that's the power of focus. Focus. The future of your company depends on it.
Yep.
Excellent. And for my last book, cue the hate mail. It is the 4-hour work
week. I did that.
So yeah. So this book is a 4-hour work week, and I think again I need to couch this. I really liked some of the concepts in the book. I also think the book has some serious flaws and some things that I did not take away or would not personally do. There's just some things that's, where it's kind of like how to be a bullshitter. You know, it's like how to bullshit. I mean, I think that's what this section is called. And it's how you have confidence and approach people. And so I could see some people doing it. Obviously, I imagine, you know, Tim Ferriss gives examples of him doing it and getting a better, you know, getting upgraded to first class on an airplane or whatever. And it's just kind of being really a little pushy for my taste. It's like, that's not kind of not my DNA. But at the same time, I could see this really fitting with people. But anyways, back to what I did take away. When I read this, I think it was 2007 when it came out, and there are some downright revolutionary things in this book. He talks about not putting off retirement. He says people put off retirement till they're 65. They work their whole lives, and then they retire, and they get really bored, and there's nothing for them to do. And he's basically like, try to figure out how to work less now. And he goes through all these approaches of doing it. And you've probably heard this concept so many times since he's written the book, but before then, it was like, oh, is that even possible? And then in the book, he goes through examples of himself doing it and a bunch of other people. Now, he also goes through some really cool time-saving tricks. And this is where the first time I had ever heard this, and most people ever heard it, was to only check email once a day or twice a day, to like stop checking it all the time, and to not check it first thing in the morning, to check it at like 11 a.m. and 4 p.m. so that in the morning, you knock something out real quick. And so he has a bunch of tips and tactics like that that I started applying pretty quickly. And of course, I go in and out of, you know, of doing them, but I do find that when I'm at maximum productivity, I'm doing these things. He also teaches you how to speed read.
Quick question. Do you not check your email until like 11 o'clock?
No, I have a tough time doing that. I have gone months where I have done that, but I'm not currently doing that. I find that when I have a project that I am working on and I'm into, I will not check it until mid-morning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I just haven't been doing that lately. So that's what I'm saying. Like, I do it sometimes, and I wish I could do it all the time, but lack of discipline allows me to slip back into old patterns. But I did shut off. After I read this book, I shut off. I had the Google toaster, you know, that would pop up when yep. every Gmail arrived. He goes into how to eliminate tasks, and this is the first time I'd ever heard of virtual assistants. And, you know, outsourcing to the degree that I now do is really came from this book. Then there's entire sections that are totally not worth it to me, or totally just did not speak to me. Some about being salaried employees and trying to outsource your work and trying to get work from home. And there's an entire section on basically becoming an information marketer and doing stuff online. And it didn't particularly resonate with me as much as probably half the book, which just hit it right on the head for me. And then the other half, it was like, okay, I'm going to skip this part. All that to say, just the half that he talked about was really quite revolutionary for me. And it really changed my focus from, this was the seed that started changing me from that whole, the venture-backed startup mentality of want to go huge and just thinking that's the only way to go, to starting to think, oh, I can actually have smaller products in smaller niches and go from there, which is basically what I've done today and helped me develop my approach to it.
Cool.
So that's it. And you've never read it, right?
You know, it's funny. I've never read it, but I actually have it.
Yeah.
I bought it, I forget when, but it was after I bought my iPad. And I haven't had a chance to sit down and actually read it, but I do have it.
You have it on Kindle?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
And you have the second version, right? Because it's got a bunch more stuff in it.
Probably.
Yeah. I don't know. It last year or so?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Because the first version is weaker. There's not nearly as many case studies just because it was, he was writing it when he wasn't famous, you know, and then once he got famous and blew up, then all these people came out of the woodwork and said, I'm doing this stuff too, basically.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I've really kind of wanted to speak out for a while is he focuses a lot on the automation and the outsourcing, which I think is cool. But I think like you and I've talked about, Mike, it's like there, you have nothing to automate and outsource until you've built that business. Like the hard part is building a business that brings 10, 20, 30 grand a month. And I think his business was bringing 40 grand a month at the time, but he was just working so much. He was working like 80 or 90 hour weeks. Well, that was the hard part. You know what I'm saying? Was getting that business to 40K. The outsourcing and the other stuff is actually, in my opinion, in my experience now, is much easier once you have that thing in place. So, and I don't think he spends enough time going through practical steps of how to get to that point. And so I think that's probably one of the reasons that I really started doing that in my blog and why you and I connected, you know, because we're both kind of on that, we're on that side of it, of like, how do you build that business in the first place?
Right. Well, I think that you also have to keep in mind that different books are targeted towards different people. So I think that his book with the title alone hits the nail on the head in terms of getting eyeballs. But unless you're actually at that point in your business where you're making $30,000 or $40,000. Yeah, heck, even until you're at the point where you're making 10 or 20 and, you know, completely self-sufficient, automation doesn't do a whole heck of a lot for you until you have something to automate. You know, that's just going to be a basic fundamental problem. So a lot of the other books that we talked about tonight have the same sort of thing. And we already discussed it a little bit in terms of, you know, you and I looked at different books and I looked at the 22 immutable laws of marketing. I said, wow, this is really eye opening. And you looked at it and said, yeah, this is, you know, pretty rudimentary stuff. But the reason is because you looked at it after you had already kind of educated yourself to a certain point. It was one of the first books that I'd read. So to me, it was a lot more eye opening than it was to you. It's the same exact material. It's just we read it at different points in our career trajectories.
No, that's cool.
I recently read Rework as well.
Okay.
I don't know if you've read that yet. It's from 37 Signals. So
I skimmed it in the bookstore. It was pretty short.
It was short.
Yeah. Did you get anything out of it? Like that was practical that has changed the way you work?
No, I don't think that I saw anything that was earth-shatteringly eye-opening or anything like that. But I didn't feel like it had information in it that was not valuable either, that wasn't important for people to understand and know.
Sure. It was worth your time to read it, and you felt like it expanded your
view. At no point did I feel like it was a waste of paper.
Right.
And it was on my Kindle.
Right. Nice. But no, it's less important if it's a waste of paper. It's more important if it's a waste of your time. Did you feel like it was a waste of your time?
I don't think so. At the very least, it was entertaining. And, you know, I have to be honest, I really liked the fact that what they did at some point was they went through the book and they said, this is way too long. And they basically chopped it in half.
Yeah, and I heard that.
And if you look at what's left, it's short. A lot of it doesn't explain itself very well. And they kind of leave it up to you to, I'll say, recognize or at least feel like they've done the research behind it. And I think there's definitely a couple of places where it probably falls short on that, because I'm still skeptical of certain pieces of the information that I found just because of that. But at the same time, I value my time highly. So I'm appreciative of the fact that they kept it short intentionally. You know, they were conscious of that.
Yeah, I also felt the book was entertaining. I think it's probably pretty revolutionary for people who aren't totally engulfed in the tech startup world, because as I read through it, I was like, yep, knew that, you know. And it was I've either read that from 37 Signals already, or just kind of know it from experience, or have already heard it. I mean, it wasn't anything new that I didn't take anything away from it that changed my perception or my workflow at all. However, they were not aiming it at me. Right. I mean, it was aimed at the New York Times bestseller list. It was aimed at the mass market. And I would guess, and from what I've heard people talk about it, who I know, like, you know, just at meetups and such, who are just like, oh, that book just blew my mind. You know, it was totally new stuff. And it's like, so I think they probably nailed it for that demographic.
Yeah, definitely. And I, like I said, I mean, they take these, you know, real small bullets and they break them down into a couple of pages, and they basically write a very well-written essay about that one thing. Picking fights, for example, in order to help validate your market and make sure that, you know, you have something to fight for with your product. It's just interesting the way that they've put all that stuff together, and I think they did a really good job with it. You know, I got to give them props for it.
Yeah, that's cool. They're definitely phenomenal marketers and excellent writers.
Mm-hmm.
Good communicators.
Yep. I also liked at the end of each chapter they had, you know, some references. So if you really wanted to go through and do some of the additional research and stuff, you could.
That is cool. Yeah, I didn't see that. I think that wraps us up for today. And I'm not going to read the traditional outro, because I've had a couple people say, you know, when the outro spins, I just turn the podcast off. So we're not going to do that now.
Oh, what are we going to do?
I don't know. We're going to just kind of say that if you want to get in contact with us, you can email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. I definitely have to say that our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's used under Creative Commons. And if people want to read a transcript, you think anyone reads the transcripts? Should we keep doing that?
I read the transcripts.
You read the transcripts? You're the guy talking. You're not supposed to read your own.
I know, but I don't want to listen to you.
No, this is awesome. Just get better and better. So they can come to our website, startupsfortherestofus.com. And we actually would love to get some reviews and some comments in iTunes, because that dramatically impacts how we rank in iTunes. If you just go to iTunes and search for startups, then you'll find us. And please, you know, give us a good rating and a good comment. And if you have negative things to say, please don't post them there. Email us directly. And that's about it. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.